name is Mohammed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, very nice to meet you. Yes. Oh, Simon says such good things about you.
Really?
Oh, yes. Simon goes on and on. And Melanie, too, I think. Have you worked with Melanie, too?
Yeah. I used to work at Melanie's center for a few years, and with Ron Borland for a few years. Do you know Ron?
Yeah, I met Ron. I don't know him as well, but yeah.
Yeah, so I thought I'd just come and say how old you
Thank you, and I trust I can, you were prepared to continue in your, capacity, because it's been such a help, and I'll tell you that this is not my strong area, so as I explained to Simon.
It wasn't Simon's strong area. Either.
I know, that's what he said.
It doesn't need to be, so that's why.
Well, very nice to meet you.
And what is your main area?
You mean my main area of research, or?
Research work.
Well, my discipline or my main area? My PhD is in nursing and health policy. But policy and the tobacco industry, and particularly the tobacco industry's strategic positioning. I mean, I think somewhat similar to Simon in many respects, in terms of, I've always been fascinated the way they position themselves in relation to tobacco control, and the way they constantly shift and mutate and sort of alter their public face in order to stay alive. So my research is almost all tobacco industry documents. So if you're staying for this session, you'll see a bunch of it.
So a few years ago when they became available, actually,
died and gone to heaven. I mean, I was so excited, because
are they continuing to be available?
Yeah, they are continuing. Actually, new ones are continuing to be released. Of course, they're less valuable gradually, because now they don't put it all down on paper, because, they know it's going to get, it could get, subpoenaed later, but... there is still stuff, though. We actually have documents clear up into the 2000s. So, and they are still interesting. But anyway, I suppose, do you have?
You've got 1 minute. You're maybe a minute faster, maybe I'm a minute slow, but I think it's a good time.
Pretty close.
Good to meet you.
Yes, very good to meet you. So I'm sure we'll see each other again at editorial board meetings or other meetings. Yeah. Another minute or so? Hello and welcome. It's not on. Okay. Do I have to push something? Like, it should be on. Okay. technical support? Is something unplugged? No. Push. Push. Yeah, just have to read this fine print. Welcome. This session is Killing Us Softly, Public Health Implications of Tobacco Industry, Corporate Social Responsibility. And I'm just going to give a quick introduction to what we're going to cover in this session and introduce our panelists. First, presenter disclosures for everybody. I need to start by saying that I own one share of Philip Morris USA, Philip Morris International, and Reynolds American for research and advocacy purposes. And I and Patricia McDaniel, another speaker on the panel, served as consultants for the Department of Justice in the United States of America versus Philip Morris et al. Now, just to say a little bit first about corporate social responsibility. This is a term that really has a lot of different meanings. It can mean things like giving money to good causes. It can mean things like cleaning up your environmental footprint, publishing social reports. All kinds of things fall into this rubric of corporate social responsibility, which has also attracted a lot of critique. One of the distinguishing factors of corporate social responsibility is that it maintains this distinction between what business does and the rest of the social world as being sort of two different things that have to be somehow brought together through CSR. Often it's seen as an alternative to government regulation, something businesses do so they don't actually have to get regulated. And it's become an umbrella term largely for this idea of businesses' impact on society, the impact of their supply chains, their overall relationships with society. And I think there are some real questions that we're going to take up in this panel about what that means in relation to an industry like the tobacco industry. So just a quick overview of what we're going to cover in our session. First, a talk on tobacco industry corporate image by Lizzie Friedman. Next, a talk on credibility, corporate social responsibility, and the industry by Patricia McDaniel. Philip Morris's societal alignment strategy by Joshua Yang. Corporate philanthropy, lobbying, and public health policy, which I will deliver. A talk about Big Tobacco's other philanthropy to think tanks and policy institutions by Laura Tesler. And finally, a talk by Dori Apollonio about the tobacco industry's WeCard program and its relation to corporate social responsibility. So just to say briefly a little bit so that everybody doesn't have to cover this in their talks about these talks are all based on analysis of industry internal tobacco company documents that were released as part of the 1998 Master Settlement Agreement. I'm assuming that probably most of those in this room know about this, but these were documents from five major tobacco companies and the Tobacco Institute and Council for Tobacco Research, originally just available in a paper depository, now available online. They include a vast variety of material, some 50 million pages of material, that comprises letters, memos, advertising documents, business plans, people's day-to-day diaries, you name it, and it's in there. So all these talks are based on reviewing and analyzing these documents, which are now all archived online, available freely to anybody, anywhere in the world with an internet connection. It needs to be a fairly fast one at the Legacy Tobacco Documents Library. And so we'll start with our thinking about discussion questions that we might have. We're going to hold questions until the end. Since we have six presenters, we have a lot to get through in a short time, and we want to get out on time. But a question to think about is, can there be good CSR from a tobacco company? How should tobacco control advocates frame industry CSR efforts? And should industry CSR be regulated? And if so, how? So just some things to think about as you hear these talks. And the first talk by Lizzie Friedman.
Thank you, Ruth. Does this sound okay for everybody? I tend to sort of talk too loudly. I'm Lizzie Friedman. I'm from the Public Health Advocacy Institute at the Northeastern University School of Law in Boston. And I'm going to be talking to you about the tobacco industry's trying to improve their corporate image and the investigation I've done on a particular set of documents and how what I'm finding in the documents contradicts their improved corporate image. So this is a program that I'm a program being sponsored by the American Legacy Foundation, and what I'm doing is looking at a specific set of documents, and the project objective is to educate and energize state tobacco control programs, counter-marketing, and intervention efforts by making available to them information about how the tobacco industry uses psychology and public relations to improve its corporate image. The set of documents I'm looking at, there's about 8,800 documents, came out of the Department of Justice's racketeering case. And this particular set of documents, mostly what the tobacco industry tried to do is to say that there was an attorney-client privilege, which would mean that they were prepared in anticipation of litigation. And the court found that there was no privilege, and they turned over the documents. So just to put you in the picture a little bit legally, you know, the legal strategy is what we call a scorched earth tactic. And what they do is they try to just make it extremely expensive to litigate these cases or prosecute, in the case of the DOJ. And they try to hide documents that are important either from plaintiffs or prosecutors by claiming legal privilege. And they'll just either flood you with documents or they'll try to blanket everything with privilege. And sometimes the lawyers have to go through them. Sometimes even the court has to go through them one by one. And right off the top of my investigation, I found the most ridiculous document. You tell me whether this is worth thousands of dollars of lawyer's time to shield this. This is an undecipherable plant name. It's a plant from the parsley family. This is a text from Taylor's Encyclopedia of Gardening. And that was that's something that they're trying to shield from privilege. So just a little humor there. So basically, the tobacco industry is trying to improve its corporate image. And I'm not going to talk a great deal about that because my colleagues here are going to do a great job doing that. But basically, what they're trying to do is to convince the public we've changed, and they're trying to counteract old perceptions. And what I'm going to be sharing this information with the state tobacco control programs through a webinar and through fact sheets is to show them how they can use this document-based information to show that it's really just a sham, it really is just a PR spin, and that the things that the tobacco industry says privately when they think that nobody's looking or they're not going to have to turn over their documents is very different from the image they're trying to project. So the first couple of documents I'm going to be talking about is documents pertaining to their specific corporate image improvement efforts. And then the rest of the documents are on substantive topics that conflict with that message. And basically, the contradiction is, you know, between the PR spin. What I found was documents where they admit that they're targeting and marketing to various populations, youth, women, minorities. They have manipulated the science of cigarettes. And they've also tried to fight regulations such as to protect smokers from secondhand smoke. And basically, it's just a real classic conflict between corporate image and internal statements. So the first document is they're talking about Philip Morris launched a website in 1999, and in talking about it, they said, "It is our policy to align our public communications regarding this issue with the conclusions of the public health authorities. It doesn't matter that we believe our views are correct. Our policy is designed to do our part to ensure that there will be a single, consistent public health message on this issue. If we are sued in court or otherwise required to specify our technical scientific views with precision, we will, but we will not do so proactively." So basically what they're saying is, to the public, we're going to say whatever they want to hear. But when the rubber hits the road, when we've really got something at stake, whether it's being prosecuted by the DOJ, being sued by plaintiffs, or possibly being regulated, then the gloves are off. Another document laid out their general objectives, which included improve the company's credibility with the public at large, as well as opinion leaders. Enhance our ability to reject allegations about the past by showing desire to do something dramatic about the future. Secure recognition of Philip Morris as a company with reasonable solutions to end the current hysteria swirling around the tobacco industry. Which is funny because this is a 1994 document. If they thought that was hysteria, things got a whole lot worse. So now moving into more substantive topics that we think could be of use to state tobacco control programs. For instance, marketing to youth. Here's a document that said, so long as we continue to market our products to adults in any way, that's their emphasis in the document, we will remain subject to this skepticism and distrust. It's fundamentally true that it is impossible for us to engage in marketing that is simultaneously appealing to a 21-year-old smoker and repulsive to a 17-year-old smoker. As long as we market at all, we will stand accused of marketing to kids. They're letting it all hang out, but when they are asked in public, they adamantly deny that advertising causes anyone to start smoking. They say it's all about peer pressure, and that parents need to do a better job, and that you need to regulate youth access, but it has nothing to do with their ads. Another thing they do is they try to influence scientific studies by stacking the panel with their hand-picked scientists whom they know are predisposed to find what they want them to find. And here is an email from the wonderful General Counsel Mary Ward from R.J. Reynolds, who, when she opens her mouth, she tells the truth, which is fabulous for researchers. She's talking about John Rupp, who's sort of the dark knight lawyer from Tobacco Institute, trying to manipulate studies on secondhand smoke. RJRTI has been trying to rein John in. RJRTI and PMI have come to realize that the projects come out better when they are scientist-planned and when the scientists choose the investigators on meritorious grounds, not when John chooses his scientist friends with the aim of trying to teach them something. Also, John has shown an amazing insensitivity in the way he continually proposes using CIAR as money conduit for things that are purely and simply rough projects and not properly funded by the center. So it's interesting, even she's sort of realizing, well, I think we might be going a little too far. Another really important figure in the tobacco industry's effort at deception and PR is Gray Robertson, who was the president of Healthy Buildings International. They were an indoor air quality company whose almost sole client was the Tobacco Institute. And the Tobacco Institute hired them to conduct studies of indoor air quality and then to find that you don't need to ban smoking, you just need to improve ventilation. And what they did with Gray Robertson was they got him all trained up with some PR classes and sent him out as a member of their truth squad, very Orwellian. And the focus on secondhand smoke, there are a ton of documents in this collection that focus on ETS. I think the reason is because the tobacco industry knew, even in the 90s, that if you make it less acceptable to smoke in public and if you make fewer public places available to smoke, people will smoke less, they may even quit. And so that still to this day is really their last frontier. They absolutely have to fight with everything they have, any type of regulation for secondhand smoke. So in the late 80s, Philip Morris asked Robertson's to consult just for them instead of for the Tobacco Institute. And he said, well, I'm going to have to turn you down, because he realized that if he worked for one specific company, it would become abundantly clear to regulators who he was testifying in front of and to, the Today Show and all these other shows he was going on, that there was a real connection, a real nexus between HBI and the tobacco industry. And he said, our greatest attribute is the fact that we are an independent company whose views occasionally and coincidentally coincide with the tobacco industry views. Despite massive media attention to date, no one has identified such a link. Much of our success to date has been due to the, quotation fingers, invisible bond that exists between HBI and the tobacco industry. I love that he uses his own quotation fingers. He warned that by too closely associated with any tobacco company, we will undoubtedly damage our value as unbiased and independent expert witnesses. Contrast that with what happened a little later in the 90s. A whistleblower who worked for HBI came forth and said that Gray Robertson himself and his cronies had been tampering with the indoor air quality studies and had been changing the results because even with their biased standards, they still couldn't get it to say that you didn't need to ban smoking. And so Congressman Waxman held hearings. And this is a letter from the president of the Tobacco Institute pushing back and denying that there was actually a connection between them and Gray Robertson and his firm. He says, neither TI nor any tobacco company funded this inspection, was involved in any way in the inspection or preparation of the report, or in any way influenced Mr. Robertson's the efforts in this regard. And we know that's a lie. So basically, and this doesn't obviously come as a shock to anybody in the room, tobacco industry says one thing, does another. And what we'd really like to do with this program is to help the state tobacco control programs get that message out, either on its face as a counter-marketing tool, or at least to help inform them on how to use document-based research to make their point. And so what we're going to be doing is we're going to be having a webinar, and we're also going to be producing downloadable briefs, short fact sheets for state tobacco control programs so that they can share the information with each other. And what we did before we started doing our document research was we conducted a needs assessment, and we found an amazingly high amount of knowledge about tobacco industry documents in the state tobacco control program. So I was very encouraged by that. Most of them, about 60, high 60% have some passing knowledge of tobacco industry documents, and virtually all of them feel that they could use this as a helpful tool to help them with their counter-marketing. And we're sort of still in the middle of the research, but what we also plan to look for, excuse me, in addition to targeting youth and secondhand smoke and the various other things that I've come up with is tobacco industry attitudes about light cigarettes and various other disparities of focus groups that they focused. I found a bunch of documents on how they really targeted the Hispanic community and also did a lot of charitable work in the Hispanic community to try to build that bridge. And like I said, I'm not going to stray into the area that my colleagues are going to be talking about. But ultimately, I think what we're going to find is that the things that the state tobacco control programs are worried about and focused on, they pop up in the documents. And this research is just tremendously helpful. And if we can get the information to the people who can make use of it, I really think we'll have completed the circle and we'll have done our job. Thank you.